Welcome to the Great Base Tennis Podcast. This is your co-host, Andy Fitzell, alongside Steve Smith, episode 40. In this episode, we're speaking with David Secker, who is one of the coaches at NC State, the women's program.
Yeah, this week, the next 2 weeks, actually, half dozen miles, 5.5 miles from our doorstep, NCAA Team Championships, Division One. First week, the team, second week, individuals. Their team has really climbed NC State with... let's get David on the phone.
So we're going to give him a call.
Should be fun.
He's a jolly Englishman. Here we go. Get him on the line.
His head coach is an Englishman, too. Lots of fish and chips.
Get on that mic, Rambo.
Hello, hello. Fish and chips.
Good afternoon. Would you like tartar sauce with your fish and chips?
So you heard that.
I hear some slandering of the Brits going on.
Yeah. No. It was all good. Mary Poppins.
Mary Poppins. I really like England.
You know, London.
David. Yeah. Great to have you on our podcast.
Yeah, thanks for coming on the show.
Well, thank you for having me on. I've been enjoying this podcast. And hopefully I actually contribute something. I feel like I've skipped the line of people you should be talking to, but I'm excited to get some information out there.
Well, we were really struggling with guests this week, so we just thought since you're in town, we'll give you a call.
Yeah, but let's go.
No, it's going to be great.
Teasing about the fish and chips, but you and Simon, the head coach, Earnshaw, you guys are doing a great job.
Yeah.
Both from England. Tell us a little bit about your background. We'll get going with you and Simon and talk a little bit about the team.
Yes, through the all English coaching staff. We just had a good day yesterday. The NC State Women's Tennis made their first Elite Eight. We won the round of 16 here yesterday.
Yeah, congrats. We were there. We enjoyed it.
I appreciate you guys coming out to watch. We had a really good support as well. It's been a long, long time, but to give you a little background, Simon and I now are going on 20 years. I played for him in college. I'm from West London, a town called Hayes. If you've ever flown into Heathrow Airport, you've flown over my house, the town next door. It's a, I wouldn't say it's a tennis mecca, but it's a, you know, it was a pretty working class area when I grew up. It was quite well known for sports, but not tennis. But I grew up there in the English system. You know, I was a reasonable junior in England. I spent a few years in Spain. I was lucky to get a little bit of grant money and get out to Barcelona in the late 90s, which was really, for me, like totally changed the picture for me and on how things went. And then I'm sure we're going to touch on rules at some point, but I was someone who became ineligible in Division One. Back in those days, Division One, you could play 1 year of tennis after you graduated. I graduated a little early. I miscalculated my numbers and played. I appeared in a main draw of what used to be called satellite, now the futures, but after a year of graduation. So really only go Division Two. Back in those days, Division Two, you could play up to any age, really, as long as your expenses didn't outweigh your prize money, which certainly was not an issue for me. Some friends of mine kind of put together a list of schools to Division Two, really helped me out. And I talked to Simon, who at the time was his second year as a coach. I think he was 28 at the time. And I talked to Landa, Joe Cabri, who at the time were also a very good school. So I ended up at Armstrong Atlantic State University in Savannah. It's a beautiful place. That's kind of where it got started for us. Yeah, but Simon had to deal with me as a player and now as a coach. Yeah. Well, he tolerated me.
The biggest sport was... A lot of footballers around your neighborhood, or did you get into soccer?
Where I'm from, boxing and soccer. Yeah, school I went to is quite a well-known soccer program. I mean, I can tell you, we only have two systems of school, primary and secondary. We don't have the middle school like they do in the US. Mm-hmm. But to give you some perspective, that the equivalent of sixth and seventh grade, we went 2 years without losing in our soccer program. Which, I mean, if you're at that level in London, these kids can play a little bit, you know?
Yeah.
So it was really a big sports culture of soccer. Boxing was big because my father had a little bit of a background in that. But we had a public swimming pool attached to our school. So I was in the pool. My mother, a doctor told her when I was younger with asthma that swimming would help. So my mother being the way she is, signed me up immediately for that. And I spent a lot of time in the pool. But no, it's, yeah, soccer is king. If you can't play soccer, they kind of disown you where I'm from. Yeah.
And then how'd you happen to choose tennis?
A little bit randomly. I mean, I think you've touched upon it here, but for sure sports were seasonal when I was growing up. You kind of tried different sports at different times. My kind of what you guys would call homeroom teacher was the PE teacher. So any time the sun came out in England, we really just were playing sports. And I remember doing tennis in school. I didn't really start until I was about 9, 10. And he could actually play a little bit. And we were playing. He said, you know, if you want to hit a little bit more, you can do like the next class and do the tennis class again. So he kind of got me going. And my dad was a pretty athletic guy. And he just liked tennis. So he said, you want to go down the public courts a little bit? And we just started playing. And it kind of just started from there. I have no real, I mean, my mother, I've never seen her hold a tennis racket. My dad just literally was an athletic guy who could just picked it up himself. But we really didn't have any background in tennis.
What was it, some of the differences between your training in England and then your training in Spain?
Well, yeah, I mean, the LTA is, you know, I always laugh when I hear criticisms of the USGA because I think obviously federations sometimes are an easy target, but us in England, we like to moan a little bit. And the LTA, the system I grew up in, I mean, looking back now, to me, it was pretty good. I was lucky because a couple towns over, my mum found a club where it was juniors only, and the controller of London Tennis was based out of there, and her husband, Jeff Bone, was the director of the LTA junior program at that time. And the lady in question, Jane Bone, she was basically just running all the juniors in London. So she had a club where only juniors were allowed. Basically, there was clinics every evening. You know, in London, we get around on the buses and trains. So most London kids have free transportation within the city. So kids would just arrive, buses right. and trains from school, play in the evening. She ran a huge ladder league. Like Friday nights there, I think they had 18 courts. Every court was a ladder league match. And she was really the point person. And she, I can tell you I remember one year at 14 nationals, I think it was a 32 draw. She had 19 of the players. So she was just totally controlling the London players. And she had this system for us. And, you know, the ladder leagues and the clinics that she was running there were really, it's kind of the London training base. And then once you kind of got to a certain level, she would pass you on up the chain through her husband and things like this. But in England, it definitely was an after-school sport at that time. I mean, there was no such thing as an academy or online schooling options. It really was an after-school thing. I would say English players, obviously, we're growing up on very, very fast courts. I mean, artificial grass in the summer, carpet in the winter if you could get onto the indoor courts. Basically, if you could get to a certain level, clubs would pick you up and use you to play for their teams and let you practice on their courts. So that was kind of the ticket in to some of the nicer clubs for most of the people I grew up with. If you could get to like a pretty good level, they would use you on the teams and say, okay, well, the membership's waived, but you have to play this many matches, you know? Yeah. And that's how I did it. And I think a lot of people from where I'm from, that's kind of how they grew up doing it.
How old were you when you went over to Barcelona then?
I was 17. So I graduated a little early from school. Basically, I'd done all my coursework. I just had to come back for the exam. So I was 17. Basically, halfway through my senior year, I went for people I'd trained with had talked to me about this, what they call pretemporada preseason, how tough it was and how good it was. So I kind of signed up to do that for 3 months and ended up staying for about 18 months.
And that was all on clay that you played?
Actually, we rotated week to week. So you'd spend a week on clay, a week on hard. It was at Cambia, which is now it's called Bruguera Tennis Academy. Back then it wasn't really an academy back then. It was kind of a club, but it had a certain section of it that was organized. It was called Top Team back then, but it was up in the mountains just outside of Barcelona.
Certainly a lot more sunshine.
Yeah, we didn't have to worry about indoor court. I don't even know if there is an indoor court in Barcelona, but No, that was, I mean, it was just the fact that you could play all day. I mean, we'd heard stories. I mean, we'd seen Spanish players at the kind of the team events and international stuff, but you hear stories about, you know, these guys are training 6-7 hours a day and the fitness they're doing, and you're like, some of it you think is urban legend, and then you get there and they give you a schedule and you've got 3 tennis sessions and 2 fitness sessions each day. They're not messing around, right?
Yeah. All right. There was a big center. I forget what it was called. I was there a couple of years ago and they did have some indoor courts, but.
The joke was there's 1 indoor tennis court, and if it's booked, whoever has the highest ranking gets it. If it rains, whoever has the highest. So it's like, well, Moya was #1 in the world, so he's got it booked. It was like, you're not going to play on it.
Yeah.
You mean, are you going to go run in the mountains or you're going to go play soccer or something? You're not. If it rains, you're not going to be playing tennis.
Yeah.
Oh, that was a policy at Balotelli's for a long time, where a junior could be using court one, the top court, but the best player shows up and they get court one. The juniors just have to leave.
Yeah. And then you played all 4 years, right? At Armstrong, Atlantis?
Yeah, I did. I played for Simon. It wasn't too unsimilar to what happened at NC State. I mean, Simon inherited a program that had been good. Certainly the women's program was good, but the men's program was a little bit of a mess. Coach before him had got let go because of some issues. Simon, to give you a perspective, I think Simon's first year he was the coach, there were 2 players on the team who were older than him. You know, in Division II back then, it wasn't rare a player would be 29, 30 years old, you know?
Yeah.
So Simon had to do some work. He got myself and another English player. I think the first year I got there, we were ranked 20 to 25 in Division II, which isn't a great level, to be honest. By my junior year, and I think from my junior year on, they were never out of the top 3. But Simon really had to do the cleanup work to really get the program turned around. But I was there for the first 2 years of that. I was kind of involved in that. And from really my junior year on, it looked like what people associate with the Armstrong programs now.
When you say cleanup work, what does that entail?
Culturally, I mean, it was like there wasn't the structure. They had really good players coming in, but it's like people had a deal. You know, so, well, I play these matches, but maybe I have to go home to Germany before NCAAs for this.
Yeah.
Fitness was dependent on the time of year or how people were feeling. It wasn't the most structured program. They definitely had good players, but it wasn't really like that controlling voice from the top.
Yeah.
And, you know, for those of you who've met Simon, he's a very organized person. And it really, after my sophomore year, we had possible 7 returning players, and we had 2 graduate. 7 were eligible to return. He cut 5. He kept myself and the other English guy. Had a meeting with us and said, all right, we are starting again. This is how it's going to be. You 2 will be the captains just because no one else is coming back. And this is what it's going to look like. And he really just transformed the program from there. The women were always doing well. I mean, they were always a high level. He inherited a good program and he made them better. But the men were, we were a bit of a mess my first 2 years and I think the couple of years before that, but he really got a hold of the men's team.
So he coached both teams. That's obviously
he coached both teams with a graduate assistant.
Yeah, I was going to say tough assignment with just 1 graduate assistant or a couple?
1.
Wow. Yeah. I think your listeners, college tennis, I mean, I tell parents all the time, you know, there's almost 5,000 colleges and there's D3 and D2 teams that can beat D1 teams. There's, you know, scholarships. What's the difference in scholarships generally between D1 and D2?
So men's is the same. It's 4.5 Division 1, Division 2. So Simon, no difference for that. Women's in Division 2 at that time, you could have 6 full scholarships. In Division 1, it's 8. So that was kind of the key difference. The biggest difference really was the rules and then the support. It's really the support stuff. You know, Simon was running 2 teams with 1 graduate assistant. So it's not a full-time paid assistant. So I think a lot of Division II programs would run their practice at the same time because, you know, at the end of the day, it's tough on the coach, right? Simon was running the programs completely separately. It's like, you know, he was in women's mode, their practice would end, their fitness would end. Then he would turn over and do, you know, then he would switch gears to the men's program. And he ran them as two separate programs, which was tough. I mean, very, very tough physically and time consuming.
So now the two of you are at North Carolina State University, but before we talk about your climb with NC State, Simon won a bunch of national championships. And then I read where he says you were part of seven of them, seven of nine. Is that right?
Yeah. So when I graduated, Simon won nine. I was there for seven. So when I graduated a year, about 6 months before graduation, I think the winter, probably end of semester meeting, he said to me, what are you going to do when you graduate? He said, I don't think you want to play anymore, do you? I said, no. He said, do you want to go to graduate school? I said, I think so. He said, generally, if you don't know what to do, go to graduate school. I think, you know, you would like doing the graduate assistantship with me. He said, if you want it, let me know. Go home over Christmas and tell me after Christmas. And I said, yes, I think I would like to do that. So I remember my senior year, we lost in the quarterfinals, the men's team. And then the very next day, he said, all right, you're on third doubles and four singles with the women, semifinals and nationals. He just said, here we go. And yeah, that's kind of how we started. And in the run we had together when I was the graduate assistant, we won seven. So four with the women, three with the men between 2007 and 2012.
So you got some rings?
Got a few. Yeah, I gave most of them away.
Really? Well,
I like to give them to people. I gave one to our bus driver. I gave one to our missions lady. I gave one to my mom. I like to give them. I like the rings, but I like to give them. I like designing them and people getting them, but I like giving them away. I enjoy that.
No, that's great. With the national titles, how does that work? I have a question for example, here in Florida, to get to the Division II Nationals, how do you qualify? Don't you have to do it in a little different way than Division One?
Yeah, slightly different. So in Division One, the 16 regional hosts are based on ranking. So, you know, they can be anywhere in the country. In Division Two, the 16 regional hosts are based on the top two by region. So it's a little different. So the difficult part is, you know, for example, the Southeast or Florida, you might have a top 10 team that doesn't make it out of the regional who doesn't get to the round of 16. Whereas in Division One, that top 10 team would be a host. So even if there was four top 10 teams in the state of Florida, for example, there'd be four hosts. But in Division Two, you couldn't do that. There would only be two hosts in the state. So sometimes in Division Two, in the round of 16, there would be a little bit of a gap where maybe the number 25 team gets through from a not so strong region. So it's a little different, but we play same, pretty much the same, two rounds on campus, round of 16 at a national site. In Division Two, though, we're not as soft as Division One. We play 4 days in a row, winner takes all. We don't have these nice days off in between.
But to win a national title, you still have to beat the best.
Yeah, I mean, once you get to the pretty much the semis on, it's going to be the top teams. Yeah.
And why so much success at Armstrong Atlantic?
We were organized. I mean, we evolved. I mean, it got better and better. I mean, it started with fitness. You know, Simon has a Bolteri background. He worked in the summers for Bolteri and some of the Bolteri properties around the country. But, you know, Simon, you guys talk on here about measurement, measuring something, you can improve it. Simon could tell you, I'm sure he could find it, you know, my freshman year on a Tuesday in October, what my times were on a 400 workout. He was recording everything. And more so with the fitness, but he had it down to, it's like, this is what we do. We're going to keep doing it over and over again and recording it. And as long as we show that we're improving, we're going to keep doing it and upping it. And basically each year we would sit there in the summer and just try and add new parts to the program. You know, I think we were one of the only Division II programs with a full strength and conditioning program. We didn't have a coach, but I did my graduate degree in sports medicine, and
yeah,
there was a Team USA lifting coach there. And one summer, he literally just taught me how to teach lifts. And then we added different more complex lifts to the program. Our conditioning program was, I mean, if we joke, but if we tried to do some of these things now, I think we'd be arrested. But we really pushed the envelope physically. And the reason being is Division II Nationals used to be in Orlando, and you had to play 4 days in a row. The scoring was all 9 points counted. So doubles was 1 point each. Mm-hmm. There was regular, it was pro set doubles. Yeah. There was regular scoring in singles. So the matches could take 5 hours. You got to do that 4 days in a row. It really was a fitness competition at the end of it.
Yeah.
It's great. And we had a huge edge with that.
I was going to say, it's great you were able to use, because you majored in psychology, right?
Did my undergrad in psych.
Undergrad in psych, yeah. And then the physical education, so you're able to use that in your coaching, which we'll talk about more, I guess, with NC State as well, the stuff you guys do.
You and Simon, now that you're just leading one team, do you feel a little bit like you're on vacation because you're not running two teams?
A bit weird having 2 days off between the 16 and Elite Eight. But, I mean, it's like we do have less basic responsibilities, but because of the level of the program and the level of commitment it takes, it is still, I would say, it's more stressful. I don't know if it's more physical work, but it's more stressful. Mm.
Well, I was working, as you know, with a group of realtors. It was flattering. They're interested in building a Tennis Smith Village, and I was asked to pick a city, and my parents had retired to Southern Pines, right outside of Piner, so I used to fly in and out of Raleigh. So I said, I think Raleigh would be a place to build a tennis facility. The lead investor went through a divorce and the whole project went from the front burner to the back burner. But I was at NC State because this group of realtors said, why don't you go to Raleigh and check out the market? And then Matt Clure, who we spent a lot of time with, he was assistant coach with the men's team. So yep. I made a phone call and went up and helped initially as a volunteer. But I was there when Simon started, and he took over a team that was at the bottom. I mean, they were let go, his predecessors. I guess to backtrack, with the difference between teaching or coaching men and women, Andy and I are a little bit baffled by they say there's a difference between the WTA forehand and the ATP forehand.
I find it totally offensive.
Yeah, I think
when
women,
people start with that.
I think women should be upset with that. But now there's all these workshops, seminars on how to train to teach females. I mean, a forehand's a forehand. I don't think the ball knows whether it's being hit by a male or female. But there already are some differences. I think with you could tell us. It's. I know people were questioning Simon, and he certainly proved his critics. I know people were saying, well, he had success in Division II, he won't have success in Division I. And I said, I doubt that. A national championship, it doesn't matter if it's in tiddlywinks. I mean, it's not easy to be a national champion in anything. So you could elaborate upon that. But then also, too, I think a lot of times if people coach women, they don't really cross over and teach men, or vice versa.
A little bit. To your first point, I mean, to your second point, Division II to Division I, our women's basketball coach just texted home this morning. He was a Division II coach. They've been back-to-back ACC champions and back-to-back round of 16. He said, I guess us Division II guys do know what we're talking about. I guess... in basketball it's 94 feet. He said, for us, it's still 94 feet, For us, it's 78. But no, I mean, difference between men and women, I have a hard time with this one as well. There is no difference. There are physical differences, of course, like in terms of levers and things like that. But in terms of hitting a tennis ball, there is no difference. For sure. Some of the net play, women are a little bit more susceptible to lobbing, but that's purely just the difference between being 5'8" and 6'4", right? In terms of training, the programs will run the same. I mean, obviously the measurement numbers and the expectations were slightly different, but the measurement numbers and expectations should be based on what the data set presents you. not some preconceived notion of men should do this, women should do this. I mean, once you've tested a certain number of athletes, the averages and things like that and kind of standards, they present themselves. They're not open to interpretation. But no, I strongly believe the game should be taught. It's a tennis player. It's not male tennis player, female tennis player, this and that. And so I think that's one of the huge credits to Simon is he's always treated people as athletes. Never this or that. My neighbor, I remember a few weeks, we were playing in the backyard and she said, I throw like a girl. I said, you don't throw like a girl. You throw like someone who hasn't been taught how to throw.
Yeah.
There's no such thing as, I find it, I've been asked by some of these workshops to talk about this and I always kind of get a little bit aggressive back about it because I don't believe that. I just don't believe in that.
Yeah, thankfully you don't hear the term tomboy. Years ago, if a girl played sports, she was called a tomboy. And yeah, that you shouldn't hear that expression anymore. You throw like a girl.
Yeah. I think the truth is women weren't given fair access to sports for a long time, right?
Yeah, and I think like for myself, I just think, you know, we used to go out and throw rocks at each other or whatever, you know, skip rocks in a lake, and maybe girls weren't doing that all the time. But naturally learned that throwing motion just, you know, growing up.
Yeah, but I think now that women's sports is expanding, you're seeing that they can do all these things.
Of course.
I just don't think it was part of the culture as much before, and there was a gap.
Yeah.
David, lots of firsts with NC State, first time in the quarterfinals. I mean, to read that NC State is, you know, beating USC, University of Southern Cal, but it's a lot of firsts with, can you talk about that? I mean, All-Americans and runs in
first,
the SEC and so records.
First Elite Eight this year, highest ranking. We got to 3 when the pandemic hit last year. NC State had never had an All-American up until they never had one. I think the program started in the 60s. We had our first one in 2019. We had 4 this year. Never finished in the top. I think we've every ACC record, NCAA record, ranking record. We've been number 1 in doubles. Number 4 in singles, that's the high. One of our girls who's a senior now has the 8 all-time ACC doubles record. She may have broken actually yesterday the NCAA doubles record. There's a few. I mean, we jokingly say somehow last year we broke the academic record as well. We had a 3.8 something crazy GPA. But
yeah, nice.
I think we have the entire book right now. I don't know what else there is for this group of girls that they haven't had a record on.
Well, obviously, Simon knows you, you know, you said half your life, so much trust. What have you brought to the table coming from your background? Well, I guess you should elaborate first upon you eventually were in junior tennis for some time.
Yes, that's probably where our story starts a little bit. After I graduated my master's degree, my wife and I just got married, and Simon and I knew things were about to change at Armstrong. We'd gone through a couple of athletic directors. There were rumblings. And obviously, the program doesn't actually exist anymore. The Georgia State system merged schools. My wife and I went to visit her best friend in San Diego. I looked at Barnes Tennis Center at the time. And then I called for a few people. Brandon Fallon and I are a few degrees of separation away from each other in age and people we know. And I got in contact with him and basically asked him a few questions about Barnes. And he then told me that they were looking to hire someone and told me a bit about their program. So I ended up at Advantage Tennis Academy in Irvine, which is run by one of your former students, Jimmy Johnson. Brandon really did everything to get me out there. I mean, my wife and I lived with him the first 2 weeks when we moved out there. He housed us. Brandon was very adamant to me. He said, look, I hire people all the time. I'm going to give you the spiel. You need to learn this system. You need to do these courses, et cetera, et cetera. If you do this, you're probably going to be successful here. If not, it's 50-50. Jimmy sat me down the first time I met Jimmy and said the same thing. I thought that was normal. Like, you get a job, you learn a system, and then, you know, you study the system and then you build your way up. So I think I was a pretty good student with it. I just started doing the Tennis Intelligence implied course a couple of times. I started shadowing Jimmy and Brandon probably for about a year. They started feeding me kind of players to work on it with. And we had a really strong after-school program of younger players, kind of the 8 through 12. So I did that with Brandon every day. And that was really a place to practice and do it. And it just kind of grew up. So I spent 5 years doing that. It evolved to something much, much bigger as the academy grew. But then, you know, Simon was always kind of knocking on the door, like, hey, you want to come back? Do you want to come back? And when my son was born, we kind of had to make a decision about where we were going to live, what the priorities were, and the timing just worked out perfectly where I ended up coming back with Simon in 2017.
That's awesome. What were some of the things that you were, you know, able to take from your college experience into the academy world, like with the juniors and things like that?
Well, I think from Jimmy and Brandon's point of view, I brought credibility for like college placement. I mean, obviously Armstrong is a Division II school, but the level of success we had, we interacted with almost everybody on the East Coast college-wise. So I had the contacts and I had the people where people who are college bound from Advantage certainly could come through me and I could help them with that.
Yeah,
I think I could run a basic group diagram. Basically, I would just run a college practice. I think you guys talked about Hopman the last 2 weeks, but I could certainly get past the eye test of I could get the players organized for a training session that looked like what a college team would be doing. And I think that was the sell for them at the time, was that I could do that. And that was pretty easy for me. You know, it's not that different taking 12, 17-year-olds to taking 8, 22-year-olds and running it, as long as they hit the ball at a reasonable level. And that was, I think, the first bit. That was why they wanted me, I think. I didn't really know what I was getting into with learning the information. I just thought, this is their system and I'm going to learn it. But obviously, I think eventually I probably got a lot more out of it than they did. But I think that was kind of how it started, was they needed a kind of college avenue or networking person.
Yeah. Did you bring some of the physical fitness side of stuff as well to the academy?
I tried very hard. And then I learned about the politics of fitness with junior tennis players, which was incredible to me. We used to joke, but like on a Wednesday afternoon, we used to do a 2 mile run and I would time it and record the times every week. And I used to joke that I should have been on commission in Irvine for the number of doctor's appointments, dentist appointments, orthodontist appointments that were booked on a Wednesday afternoon. Kids were telling their parents, hey, I need when am I going to the dentist? It's like that my knees hurt. I have shin. So they had these list of injuries and stuff. I was like, dude, we're running for 15 minutes here, 18 minutes. Like, what are we talking about? And it took a little while where I definitely had to compromise a bit. Because I realized, well, there's just certain kids who just don't really want to do it. And you're going to spend a lot of energy on those kids. But what I tried to do was just focus on the ones who did.
Why do you think there's some similarities between Orange County Housewives and Orange County Juniors?
Could be. But I tell you, we talked about this the other day. So the thing I could never understand, and I would never name names, but when you live in Orange County, you will cross paths with former athletes, professional, Olympic. You know, we had 3 or 4 different parents who'd won Olympic medals. I'm not talking about playing Division I sports, Olympic medalists.
Yeah.
And I would say to them, you know, Jimmy, your son is 14, you know, we need to get him on this program on the track and this and that. And they say, well, you know, his knees or his shins or whatever. I said, what were you doing when you were that age? I said, oh, I was training 10 hours a day.
Yeah, exactly.
I said, well, did it work for you? And he's like, well, yeah, but he's different, you know.
Yeah. Oh, I have quite a few players sent to me. I have over the years, and he's mother and father. They're both Olympians, and their child could not peel his own banana.
But it's amazing, right? It's like, did it work for you? Yes. Would your parents let you get away with that? No, 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 no.
Well, you do have to have strong extensors to do that, peel the banana.
Like a extensoritis. Yeah.
That's crazy.
So you started working with Simon. Tell us a little about that with the climb. How many years have you been there? And now, as you said, you've...
This is our fourth year. So when I arrived, we were ranked 34. Simon had done... got them back into the tournament. They hadn't been in the NCAA tournament, so basically top 40. It's 64 teams make it, but some are automatic qualifiers. So to make it in as what's called an at-large, you have to be top 40. Simon had got them in 2 years. He basically transformed it in 2 years and got them to top 40. And then the year before I came, he got them to win a round. It was the first time they'd won a round in, I think, 25 years.
Where did they start? Where did they start when he got there?
160 in college. Oh, yeah. There's 311 programs with the women, I think, in Division One. Wow. They were 160. They were the second worst of what's called the Power Fives. Wow. There's 65 Power Five schools. So they were struggling. I think they were averaging one ACC win a year for 20 years.
No, I was there. I know he inherited a mess.
What are the number one thing? I mean, what do you think the number one or two thing was coming in as far as, okay, I'm going to change this culture?
Not even close. Work ethic. I mean, I've never met the previous coaching staff. I always hear they're very nice people. I'm sure they are. Simon, you know, we have to log everything from a compliance. We log it for ourselves as well. Mm-hmm. But Simon just said, check out the practice logs.
Yeah,
and I looked at the practice logs, and I mean, we're allowed to practice 20 hours, and I can tell you, we practiced 19 hours, 59 minutes.
Yeah,
and they were averaging 8 to 10, multiple days off after a match. I mean, I just don't think they were doing enough hours to be competitive at the level that was expected. I can tell you, Simon and I are very, very different people. But the work ethic thing, that the level you have to work at, is kind of our common, really shared thing, is that you just, there's no way you can be a certain level if you're not working at least to the level of your competition or more.
Yeah.
Well, he's very intelligent, but he's also clever. I'll never forget that I was there and trying to help with the interaction between the intercollegiate teams and the club tennis teams, you know, just for many, many reasons. One, to get more fans out to the matches. So Simon had one gal join the team from the club program. And our listeners should know that these Power Five tennis teams, the universities, I mean, they're like cities unto themselves. They're, you know, they're like a big, big place, large enrollments, looks like an Olympic village. But he actually brought a player in from the club team. You know, fair enough, he was giving her a great opportunity, but also he was bringing her in to let the girls know that he inherited. I mean, this is your level. There's girls on the club team that can beat you.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a slight to the girls that were on the team before. They were recruited to a situation, and they didn't sign up to play for Simon. They signed up to play for the previous staff, and that's the way things were done. And I'm sure there were some positives to it. I mean, these girls all did well in the classroom and graduated, but you have to know what you're signing up for. So for Simon, when he came in, he had to start recruiting people who knew what they were signing up for and what the goal was, and so that they could get on board with it. And he did a really, really good job with that.
Well, in all fairness to the previous coaching staff, you know, live and let live. I've heard someone say there's between the men and women in college tennis, there's probably about 20 head coaches that wake up every day and go, I want to win the national championship.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure.
What are some of the, I think we'll get into some of the things you've done on the technical side of things, but what are some of the things you've done? I know you've done a lot with, you know, fitness, but also how you're, you know, tracking the heart rates and things like that. Tell us a little bit about the fitness.
Yeah, so at Armstrong, we were very traditional. We were on the track, the weight room, very kind of what you, I guess you would, I don't think you'd call it old school, but very how you would picture working out. At NC State, one thing, like you said, the resources we have available, both from a financial, but also from a collateral or capital side of things, are massive. So we really wanted to have a program where we had a little struggle with it. So I thought our weightlifting program at NC State was awesome. Like, we have a strength coach who's into it. He's measuring. He has a plan. And we were really happy with that. We were a little bit unhappy or questioning the conditioning side of it. So, you know, I mean, I think some programs are still questioning, should girls or tennis players be lifting weights? The answer for us is yes, often and a lot. So we, you know, if we're on a non-traveling week, we lift four times a week. On a traveling week, probably twice. But our strength coach, he's 48 weeks with them committed. On the conditioning side, we had a little bit of a switch. You know, we'd always had an extensive track program and running program. But one thing we found in Division One is we were definitely playing more than in Division Two. Some of that is because of the date rules. It's basically more dates and training days available in Division One. But once we started to do well, we found we were getting tired and a little bit worn down, but we didn't have, it was the one thing we didn't have a measure of. We were really just eyeballing it. Okay, this player's tired today. This player's getting worn down.
Yeah.
So we switched over to, we were introduced to a former professional cyclist who basically just said, you know, start tracking resting heart rates. So what we bought the girls, a basic polar watch sensor. They put it on at night.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have to do anything. But in the morning when they wake up, it syncs to their phone and it gives them just a report of their heart rate through the night. And usually your lowest heart rate of the day will occur when you're asleep.
Mm.
So we started tracking resting heart rate. We use that as a measure of recovery. And generally, the lower someone's resting heart rate is, the fitter they are. So yeah. If we could see that that was improving over time, we knew what we were doing was working. The other part of the program is that the cyclist, he comes in, he's a trained cardio tech. He does VO2 testing on them six times a year. And really from that builds workouts where we work out with a heart rate monitor on. So sometimes one of the challenges of training a group is, you know, let's say you go on a run, depending on your level of fitness, you get a different workout. So what this guy's able to do is they all have the same workout, but their numbers are based on themselves and their testing. So we have a very extensive program with that where we, every day when the player walks in, I know where they're at. And obviously you can imagine if I'm tracking nine girls every day over 3 years now, we've been running this program.
Yeah,
I know if they're recovered. I know if they're sick, stressed. We have a very good handle on where they are at cardiovascularly walking into the building.
David, tell the story you told me about the girls who were watching a scary movie and you and Coach Simon thought the next day that your girls had been out, or the night before they were out partying.
Yeah, well, that was one of the trepidations of wearing these monitors. The girls quickly started to question, wait a second, are we on the, is this like an ankle bracelet? And obviously, you know, in college, there's lots of other activities to do. And I can tell you, Simon and I, we do not discourage socializing. I think more and more in today's world, it's important for these people to socialize and have fun. But the girls, yeah, I think one of the first times we saw the numbers go through the roof, we were like, oh, I guess we had some fun last night. And they were like, no. You know, we went to watch this and this. And it was like, okay, fool me once on that one, girls. But our girls know. Our captains will send me a message sometimes in the morning and say, Dave, we had a little team bonding activity last night. I said, that's totally fine with me, ladies. As long as they know when to do it, we're okay with that. And it's not used against them. And once they figured that out, they were totally fine. No, but at first they felt like they had to explain everything. But we were like, This is not to be used against you in a court of law. This is purely so that we can plan our day's work on what we're doing. And to tie that back to the great base, one thing I think that scares coaches to death is slowing down with a player.
Mm.
You know, let's have a day where we just slow down and work on something technical, or we watch film, or we walk through a concept, right? And I think sometimes with players, it scares them. I have players who, I think it's stress relief sometimes to work very hard. But when a player walks in the door for an individual and their heart rate is out of range, so, all right, girls, we're doing technique today. But we're really just going to slow. Your heart rate's not going to get up at all today. and we can really back off and slow down. And what the girls have learned is, as a part of it, there's days where we are going to really push and it's going to look like your typical college workout and things like that. But there are days where we are going to slow completely down. So I think one of the things about the Great Base that sometimes doesn't pass the eye test for people is like, well, they're not moving or they're not running around or they're not sweating. And if you understand that in an athlete's day or cycle of a week, there are times where you do have to back off a little bit. But if you have another skill set where you can work on things without doing that, you have more tools to train players.
It's amazing. Like football, we talk about often, you know, doing walkthroughs. You know, they slow down and go through the movements, the plays.
Yeah, the great Don Shula, he was the first to want to rent the top floor of a hotel parking lot. And, you know, the hotel guests were not allowed to use the top floor. And what he would do the night before a game, you know, the players could be wearing blue jeans, but they're just going through, you know, the offensive unit, the defensive unit, the special teams going through every play. Before we talk a little bit more about slowing down and technique and, you know, the connection we have through our curriculum, I think it's very important, and you could touch upon, you and Simon are climbing the ladder mostly with American players, if not all, but your athletes, I think it's a little bit of a negative, a lot of a negative, where American kids are not around other athletes. We have some fun. Kids are always asking each other, what's your mile time? Certainly we run other distances as well, but Caitlin Tui has an American high school record of 4:33. Mm-hmm. I read where she recently had some success at the ACC track and field conference. But are your tennis players around the other athletes, like in gym settings and such?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, if we do, you know, during COVID is a great way of looking at this. So during COVID, you cannot get into our facility unless you're on a pass list, right? Mm. You know, the day before we play, I see the pass list. And I mean, it's our girls are very close to women's basketball, who've done very well, wrestling, cross country, not as much soccer, but a lot of interaction. There's a lot of interaction between them. There's a lot of camaraderie. Sometimes I can tell you, when some of these women's basketball players who walk in the building say hi to me, I look at them and just think, man, if I put a tennis racket in your hand, oh my God. No, a lot of interaction. We do have a lot of American players. One of the nice things about that is obviously they're quite into other sports. So it really helps that where, you know, you can use concepts from other sports and they like it. And we, that's a big part for sure. That's a big positive of having, you know, people, because even if, you know, if you're a wrestler or a cross country, but you're from the same town as my tennis player, there's a connection there. And I think it that helps with the supporting of sports and seeing what they're doing. You know, and we have a few sports who are doing very, very well, especially on the women's side, NC State. And the football's been good, but some of our cross-country program, our swimming program, our wrestling program, I can tell you there's a huge amount of interaction between us all and the coaches, sharing ideas and things like this.
How about redshirting? You know, we talk about college tennis. Years ago, Arthur Ashe, Stan Smith, when they were playing, they both became Wimbledon U.S. Open champions. They could not play as freshmen. I have three older brothers, and when they went to college, they couldn't play as a freshman. There's more and more in basketball, more and more red shirts. It used to be like 100% of, or close to 100% of football players would redshirt. To our listeners, that means if someone comes in, they can be part of the team, do everything but play official matches. Could you comment on that?
I mean, I think the truth is, Steve, it's not done because it doesn't work in tennis, and the reason it doesn't work in tennis is because I don't think the programs are built to develop a player like that. One of the things, it's hard to say because I'm criticizing ourselves, but I think it's actually true that it's not really, you're not recruiting players to develop them a lot of the time. You're recruiting players to win at this level, and redshirting doesn't give you that immediate benefit. I think for most players, the benefit of going to college tennis is they're going to get guaranteed matches. They're going to be in a group of players their level or better. physically they're going to develop and be more professional with it. And that's kind of where you see the level jumps. There's not too many college tennis players I've seen who really transform their game. So I think redshirting, the idea would be where you really transform the nuts and bolts, but I don't think there's that many programs equipped to do that. For sure, college tennis is making a big push that it's a pathway to the pros. Mm-hmm. Personally, I think that's a stretch. I think there are kids who can do it, don't get me wrong, but I don't think it is, personally, that in singles. I think in doubles, it absolutely is, because basically it's one of the only times a junior player or player, whatever, just really work on doubles. But no, I think the redshirting thing, it does make sense if you have the tools to do it.
Yeah.
But I don't think that's the norm.
You'd have to be pretty self-aware too as a player to come in and go, "Hey, guys, I can't volley." You know, I know you want me, but I can't volley. I want to learn how to volley this year. But then the coach as well, you guys would have to have a long-term vision for that player as well.
It's about gratification right now, where people are just thinking about what can I get now? And coaches, we're guilty of it too, right? I mean, what can I get now? And what can we do now? And what's next year going to look like, right?
Yeah.
No, but if someone really wants to play pro tennis, you know, we were at the USTA National Campus this morning and we were there yesterday. I think everybody would benefit if they could take a five-year program. How would that work financially? Would people be able to give a five-year scholarship?
No, I mean, scholarships on the women's side are until you complete your degree at the Power Five level. So they don't sign a one-year or four-year scholarship. When they sign a scholarship with us, it says until you complete your degree. Mm. So that's as long as that takes. The issue is, let's say you have eight players on scholarship, you designate one as a red shirt. Well, now you're instantly down to seven. And what happens if you have an injury or you have a player that, let's say, doesn't work out or something like that, and you go down to six, then you're walking the line, right? And I think that's what most people are scared of. Generally, what would happen if it was going to be a red shirt situation, it would probably be a situation where a player would walk on for a year, pay their own way. So a non-scholarship player, walk on for a year, really work their level up, and then go on to scholarship. And sometimes it can be because of what's available in terms of scholarship slots, but I can't think of many programs. I think a program's way more likely to sit a player out for eligibility reasons, lose a scholarship, than they would to redshirt a player to develop them.
Mm-hmm. With your skill set, because you trained yourself to be a technician, certainly you could take that challenge upon yourself to try to have, you know, some athlete from the local area.
I've tried to sell it to players.
Yeah.
But it's like, well, why would I come to you and not play when this school says they'll give me a scholarship and I'm going to play?
Yeah.
Exactly. And okay. I understand that.
That's what I mean. The player would really have to be like, all right, I've got this vision, 5-year plan. Here's what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
You know?
I think they'd also have to trust me as well, right? Or Simon, they'd have to trust us. And, you know, at the end of the day, most of the times in recruiting, it's when you start the process, you're complete strangers, right? And that's where I think the link is missing with the local programs, right? If it was a local player, that might happen.
No, that brings back a memory, because for 10 years, I was based on a junior college campus in Tampa, and I oversaw the women's team. And you know, there are some coaches that recommended players to come and play with us, train with us for 2 years, and then play somewhere else for 2 years. But yeah, we didn't have anybody say, "Okay, I'll turn down, you know, USC, UCLA, Texas, some big time schools." But in the end, if people really did their homework, I have this list in front of me. I mean, Georgia, Virginia, NC State, Southern Cal. It's just the list of matches from the other day, Texas, Ohio State, Florida State, Texas A&M, it's not that many players from these amazing universities that have actually played and climbed the ATP or WTA ladder.
No. I think personal opinion, I think we're going down the wrong route with this. trying to sell it as this, where it's like, you know, we'll take you to the province and we're the springboard and we're this and we're that. I don't think that's true. I think it should be about tennis, not trying to, I think what it's, you know, recruiting at its core is sales, right? And I think what most people are selling is whatever the recruit wants to hear to get them to commit, right? And it's something I struggle with. There's time I would joke about how bad I am at recruiting. but, you know, really, if it's about pro tennis, then we're just going to talk about your game, right? Yeah. Where are the holes, technically, tactically, physically, and mentally, emotionally, and how are we going to attack them? And it should be a presentation of information about that. But I think that's got lost a little bit. You know, obviously there's a connection to Matt Kloa and us, and Chris is in Rally, Matt's brother, and we certainly work together a lot. But I actually think a better argument would be this is a pro doubles pathway. There's nowhere in the world producing doubles teams like college tennis. I've said this to the USTA, and I'm going to say it again in a meeting in a couple of days, that to me, it is a pro doubles pathway. Pro singles, I think it's more the exception, not the rule, where we're producing those players. But that's my opinion, and it's not really the narrative of college tennis right now.
Well, I mean, everybody wants to win, too. You know, my son Connor was told by one of my former students, Tomas Olsted, he goes, hey, when you go to college, your freshman year, force on everything. Just go in. Mm. But, you know, people want to play for the win, which is understandable. In junior tennis, do we tell people that, okay, people are not going to listen to science, logic, or imagery. They just want to know who wins. Mm-hmm. And that's also with academies from a recruiting standpoint. There's obviously, you know, it's open domain. It's public knowledge. Everyone knows that there's these backroom deals where some people have scholarships. I was the first director of Seguzo Bassett, which is now Chris Everett's. And so overnight, we were like the third largest academy in the U.S. But what people wanted was, I want to be where the players are.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
So I use that word selling. I mean, perhaps down the road, you and Simon are obviously going to continue to move upward. That maybe at a different time, you could convince someone to do that. Because really, you know, people should do that. We talked about the gal who played it. UNC from Minnesota, the hockey player.
Yep.
Do you remember her name?
Jessica Aney. Yep.
Yeah. So there was a coach in Minneapolis that told her family that she should come to me and not. This is when she was in the beginning years of high school. It said you should go and spend 2 years with this guy, and preferably 2 years, and don't play one point. And she didn't do that. I understand she's back playing hockey, but. Yeah, you're just thrown in the fire right away. You know, a lot of times people don't understand the purpose of redshirting, like a Tom Brady. I mean, Mr. Super Bowl, you know, he redshirted. So it's like, okay, we have a system that you have to learn, come in, sit down, mm-hmm. shut up, and
yeah,
let's go to work. But I think that's a completely different mindset from, say,
I think that's just... such a disconnect to other sports, right? It's like, can you imagine in other sports trying some of the things that we're doing in tennis?
Yeah.
I mean, it's that. I mean, we take a lot of pride in having American players. And at the end of the day, we are a state school. Our job is to serve the taxpaying members of our state. You know, I take a lot of pride in having American players. But we would love to have North Carolinian players. That would be like the next level of pride in what we're doing. And mm-hmm. I've talked to Chris about this, and we talked about it, but somehow getting it where we can help. I mean, to give you an idea, North Carolina right now is one of the, I think it's the fourth largest tennis market in America. And we don't have a top 50 high school girl in any of the four classes. Mm. To me, that's like, that's on the coaches, where the colleges are doing great. I mean, you look at the three in the triangle, they're all in the quarterfinals of NCAAs. We've got the facilities, we've got the clubs, but the weather, we've got the people, coaches, we've got to do something to improve this, the information that's getting down to the junior level.
Yeah, no, getting a feeder system or something with the local elementary schools, a junior high, to high school, and then to play for their local.
Well, no, yeah, the big picture, I mean, certainly the curriculum we put together can help players at all levels, but beginners need to be get a better shot. And I love what you said about players from North Carolina. Years ago, Snooks Kelly, late Snooks Kelly, he was a hockey coach at Boston College. Initially, for years and years, all players from Massachusetts. And then where I was born, Potsdam, New York, he started to get a couple of players I know out of Potsdam, New York. You mentioned Matt Clor, like yourself. He's really studied our content. Patrick Gibson, a great tennis player. You know, that, I think, is the norm, is that Patrick went to college at A&M, and he played for Steve Denton, who's studied our curriculum. We spent time with Steve. And, you know, I heard Rajiv Ram say on a podcast that, you know, he only played one semester for Craig Tiley, somebody else who we worked with. And so anyway, I'm at the Easter Bowl, it's 18s, and Patrick's winning the Easter Bowl, serving and staying back. So we always say information, ideas, and insights equal instincts. But the sooner the better. I think it's not just college tennis. It's kind of like our vote for tennis teaching pros to play 15 minutes of one bounce doubles every day with 10, 11, 12 year olds. Mm. And then they would learn to play. Tell us a little bit about doubles. Tell us what your thoughts are on two bounce doubles.
I'd like to know what you guys thought about our doubles.
No, you're going forward. You're controlling the middle. It's very good. I see the technique.
Yeah, just the volley technique. I think, you know, it stands out because you just don't see it as much, you know, just simple and keeping the racket head up and hitting fairly flat.
Yeah.
Now we've talked about serve volley, you know, at one doubles, the team we have there, we have two teams in the top 10. I mean, both those teams, actually our two teams ranked higher than our one team. And you could make a very strong argument that they could play one doubles for us and be very, very good. But that one team has spent a few years together now. Last year they were ranked number one pretty much exclusively the whole year. They understand very, very basically that the best formation is two up. And there has been some work over the years as to how we get to that formation. We also understand that the worst of the three formations is one up, one back. And I think that's where people are confused by us, because they see us, they obviously people know we come forward, but they also see us when we're on the baseline, we're two back. We do not play one up. We try to come in together as a wall. And when I talk to recruits and I show them film of what we're trying to do in doubles, it's basically I'm just hitting pause. I'm like, with both feet are inside the base. All 4 feet are inside the baseline. Mm-hmm. Next point. All 4 feet are inside the baseline. Next point. You know, centering the ball and getting up. And we just keep putting ourselves in that situation. And yeah, it certainly does not work every time, but we create quite a lot of pressure where teams really, unless they're very, very cool on the baseline, are forced to lob, and then it's in our hands, right? But it's a very basic system that we run, but we practice it over and over and over again. And, you know, I think the doubles yesterday, you know, you asked me about that, but sometimes we win doubles at a rate where it almost deflates us. It was so fast yesterday. It was almost not too easy, but it's like we didn't get a level of excitement about it because it was, we know we're going to win the doubles. And we've had a lot of success in doubles. I mean, to have two teams in the NCAA championships, quite hard to do in doubles, but to have two All-American teams is even harder. So the girls, they understand. At number one this year, we went 10 matches in a row where we did serve volley on every first serve. And then we kind of came back and reviewed it. And it just, the rate, the margin on it wasn't good enough. So right now we're serve volleying like green light situations, 2 points or more. Mm-hmm. We're basically trying to play at a rhythm of two bounce. They're trying to get forward at every opportunity they can. If it is off one bounce, so be it. But in serving situations, they're serving. The big thing it's hurting is their serving percentage on the first serve is suffering when they're with serve volume because they're just not well enough trained at doing it. Second serve return, almost exclusively at one, we hit the return and come forward. That's actually easier for them to to just drive the return and go.
Mm-hmm. With round of 16 beating Southern Cal, I think it was 3, 4, and 5 that you won the sets at 6-1.
Yep.
But actually, in some ways, it's very good that you didn't cruise in the remainder of some of those matches, because you know, you don't want to have the matches be too easy.
No, you want stress, especially in this environment. You want stress and you want to deal with it.
So, but why 2 days off? You don't play tomorrow.
I think what they're worried about was if they had a rain day either yesterday or today, they wouldn't have been able to make it up. So they built in kind of an extra day as a rain day.
Okay, that makes sense. Well, Simon, obviously, he's proven to be a winner, and he's, you know, winners make changes. What changes have happened with you coming in and you bringing your background from junior tennis? You know, what has he allowed you to do, you know, coming in and being his
partner? Yeah, so, I mean, obviously, you know, when I left him to go to California, it was really, I was a version of him. Really, the information was coming from was really to reinforce his ideas. And I think it definitely helped him seeing you for that year at NC State, because it wasn't a foreign concept to him when I came back, because he knew the connection. I think he was even in Memphis when I was in Memphis with you with that group for a week or so. And so he knew the information. I think he'd obviously talked to Matt quite a bit about it and had a lot of respect for what that was. So he knew coming back, I had, you know, some different information and ideas, but a lot of it really was just adding another layer to what he already believed. I mean, Simon, in 2002, when I got to him, he was like, you know, we're going to serve almost exclusively up to the inside in doubles. I mean, this was not new information to him. He knew how to play doubles. But I think what I brought back was the ability to fix a hole. I think a voluntary trained coach or that mentality is really to focus on the strengths and kind of exaggerate the strengths, right? Build your game around the strengths and that becomes who you are. Whereas with us, we're looking to be more of the complete. So, you know, really when I came back, it was like we identified, you know, we started filming technically everything just to create a catalog and say, here's what we're seeing as a weakness. And, you know, this is her game and this is her strength. But if we can clean up the weakness as well, the strength will just get even, will come through even more. And, you know, there was a little bit of nerves at first. I joked with you. Simon used to call like the drop feeding or the shadow swinging posturing. He would say to me, Dave, we're not doing that posturing stuff. I said, okay. You know, and I would kind of do it when he wasn't looking, you know, but, once he realized what we were doing and the players, I think the worry for him was the players would react badly to it.
How did they react to it?
Totally fine. Yeah. So it helped. So for example, Anna Rogers, who played one for us yesterday, mm-hmm. she was trained by Ryan Gidley in Connecticut. There was a little bit of a connection to you. Mm-hmm. When she was a junior tennis player, she was already, when she was being recruited by Simon, she was out in California for tournaments. She came to see me at Advantage. So she already knew what we were doing. Mm-hmm. And she knew the players we had. And she asked to be filmed. And we just gave her a basic film and a breakdown and said, here's some suggestions for your coach. Ryan, I think, came out to the tournament. I went through the film with him and said, here's what we see. You know, here's our thoughts. And, you know, here's the film. Do what you want with it. So she was already on board. A couple of other players he had played like summer circuit events out in California and been to see me, so they knew me. So there wasn't that kind of like this total stranger walking in the door telling me to drop feed. And it's not like I came in and said, all right, here we go. This is a great base program. What we did was basically say, you know, where are some of the, one thing Simon's really good at, so where do we need to evolve? And I said, well, you know, I can help. Do we film the players technically? No, let's do that. And then let's see what we see. And I'll give you what I see. And you tell me what you think about that. And here's how I would approach it. What would you like me to do? And, you know, obviously we had a little bit of success doing it. And it's just grown into a thing where a lot of that has become very normal now for the players. Watching film, statting matches, drop hitting, technically reviewing things. And Mm-hmm. It's just grown into the program.
Yeah, one comment on Simon. He's a walking computer. He knows who played who and when and what the score was. I know my son Connor was playing pro tennis when I first met Simon. He knows everybody as far as anybody playing competitive tennis. He knows who they are.
And Simon, people don't know. Simon has a chemistry degree.
Yes.
He is off the charts.
H2O is water. I got that down.
Do you do any kind of review? Like, let's say, you know, if you film at the beginning of the year and then at the end of the year you film again or do anything like that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We do pre-post all the time. I mean, I think what we're going to do this summer with media, and obviously we're using it as a recruiting tool. We're starting to get a reputation as this is a place where it's a little bit different, right?
Yeah.
So what I want to do with media this year is with the players who are graduating, just showing some pre-post. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I think there was like a social media trend recently where it's like how it started versus how it's going, you know, and I'll show, Anna Rogers with her elbow, her wrist on top of her elbow in a V when she came in and, you know, now like a raised elbow, and our number three girl had a service toss to the moon when she was first here and double faulting. And we're going to do some stuff with that because it helps with recruiting. But no, we basically film start of every semester, end of every semester, and then a lot in the summer. When we slow down a little bit in the summer, we do a lot of that's where we really go after the technical piece.
And I know the physical fitness side of things, you probably do the same thing, right? As far as just where they're at measuring.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we do that really with the VO2 testing. The strength testing is easy. I mean, but and tracking the heart rates, you know, they show over time.
Yeah.
You basically just show them each month almost what's your trending, where you're at. And the girls know it. They like it. It's not like there's no secrets. Like they can tell you what they're working on. They can tell you what's working, what's not, they like the information. I think that's a little bit of a miss sometimes. I think people think players are not bright enough to interpret it or scared of this kind of stuff. But yeah, obviously you have to be careful sometimes where you put it in or how sharp you put it in. But the players, I mean, our players, they want to know.
Let me go back to Anna Rogers, who worked with Ryan Ginley. I've known Ryan a long time. When he's really young, tried to hire him to coach. He was in between one program and the next years and years ago. And 'cause he's a character coach, but I think this is a fun story. Andy and I talked to him. We've been over there two different times, and I think we've seen him in four different T-shirts.
Yeah, he's got different school T-shirts.
He's good. He's good at that. Yeah.
He's going to come in and wear the T-shirt of the former player like Anna Rogers. Another thing, too, to come back to is with Simon watching the balance training, which comes from Willie Van Horn. Years ago, Nick, who I have great respect for, Nick Politeri. I reprimand when I'll hear a tennis parent say, "Well, Nick Politeri, he doesn't know." Wait a minute, He knows so much about tennis. So, you know, don't throw stones if you live in a glass house. But Nick did say he was interviewed in Tennis Magazine or for Tennis Magazine with Tennis Magazine. He said, "I don't understand the Welby Van Horn classical stuff." So I don't write too many letters, but I've written a few over the years. And I wrote a letter to Tennis Magazine that was published. And just to speculate, you know, what would have happened at Balotelli's, because Nick was such a great motivator and so many things that he did well, if you took a Nick Balotelli and took his strengths to what he brought to the table, but they had Willie Van Horn's approach to teaching tennis. Yeah. The other day we had Manny Diaz out here at the University of Georgia. And my connection with Manny is, you know, he was trained to play by Welby. I was trained to teach by Welby. So there's all these different connections. I wanted to share one thing and go with some more questions. I think you're a great storyteller. This was a fun story for me to hear, is that you met Chad Berryhill, who was with us for 5 years. He won an NJCA national championship, and now he's at St. Leo, Division II. Two teams in the top 10, so... You had met him and you knew that he had been part of our program, and you went up and talked to him, and Berryhill said to you, he goes, did he ruin it for you too? And then you said, oh, you have a falling out with Smith. And he said, no, but once you hang around Smith a long time, use my name in third person, he said, you can never enjoy tennis again.
Never.
Because when you have an eye for it, we use the FedEd logo. Yeah. A lot of people, they don't see the arrow in the FedEd logo. And we do this at Coach's Workshop. We take the FedEd logo and we'll color it in. There's an arrow in the middle. The thing is that once you see it, you always see it.
Yeah.
You know, like, I mean, we saw a lot of really athletic, competitive, strong, fit boys playing doubles today, young men.
Yeah.
There are so many palm up overheads. I mean, it's hard to see someone with a really clean backhand volley. I don't want to take anything away from it, but you just look across the course, there's 12 players, you watch for a few minutes and go, nope, not one player can really stick the volley. In other words, if they get the elbow raised and the racket face is vertical and they play from the shoulder, then the coach can say, yeah, you need to close in. But if the elbow's down, the racket face is open, they've got a soft grip. Sorry, Charlie, you're not gonna close in with any explosiveness.
No, I said it to one of my girls today. She missed the volley. She looks at me and said, I need to close on that volley. I said, no, I need to do a better job teaching you how to volley. It's not your fault. It's not your fault. I've got to get you out front. It means multiple things on that. I mean, one, I would say, I try to not ever dig into anybody else's coaching. I try to stick to my players, but sometimes I sit in my office. There was a session a couple, 2 months ago. My office is the corner dungeon. If you've ever been to NC State, they try to keep me away from people. And one of the boys was serving, and he's a Spanish boy. He's a very good player. You're off the ground, super clean. He has the poor service motion, and he doesn't pronate. And there are three coaches on the court discussing his serve for 15 minutes. And just after 15 minutes, I couldn't take it. I just said, he's not pronating. You know, just screamed out of my office. Just film him. They all looked at me. I said, just please, just film him. Just film him.
Did you?
And they laugh. But no, I mean, but I think the other thing that people are missing in all this is, like, you talk about being on a palm-up serve. One of our biggest strengths at NC State is our players are not injured. And I think this is why the Great Break really caught my eye, because it was the first program that was talking about safety and injury and the prevention of injury. I mean, I have done many anatomy classes in my life and many biomechanics classes. If you understand the acromion process and its role in life, you will worry about your players being palm up.
Yeah.
Because that bone does not want to go down. And when it goes down,
it digs.
Bad things happen. And that is the biggest thing. Anytime we get into a discussion about why, making changes, Anna Rogers is a great example. I mean, Ryan did a fantastic job. She'll say, Dave, this. I say, always remember, Ryan was your coach. I just helped a little bit at the end. Ryan did such a good job, and he's done a good job with a lot of girls. But one thing with her is I kept her healthy. And she's made big changes in her game. But she doesn't necessarily understand that the reason I have a lot of respect for her is because she made changes. And I think people are greatly underestimating how hard it is for players to make these changes.
Yeah.
But it's number one is safety. And that's actually one of the keys to our program. Why we do so much of the fitness and all this monitoring and the slower work is because we're trying to keep these players safe and healthy. I think that's getting lost with this whole let players play, let them figure it out for themselves stuff.
Yeah, I appreciate you saying that. I think it's always good to come back to the pain of change is greater than the pain of losing, because if you change, you're going to go backwards, you're going to get worse, and the ego can't take it.
Yeah.
David, if you could mention this, the expression one bad coach is better than 10 different coaches. The players that you have, that you've had in your time in college coaching, the ones that have had the most coaches, generally are the most difficult to work with?
Well, you can look at it both ways. So the team you saw that lined up yesterday, five of the six have only ever had one coach. And it is something we look for in recruiting. So Anna, Ryan, Two, Alana, she was coached by a friend of her family's from the age of four. Three, Adriana, her mother was a French Open finalist, been a coach her entire life. Four, Jada, her father. Five, Abigail Carey, who was a coach at Bollettieri's in the 80s and 90s. And then six is the only one who's had multiple coaches. And I do feel that, and when we recruit players, it's a discussion. Because I do feel that players who have had one voice, they're not looking for, let's say, necessarily like the feel-good idea or the idea that's like, you know, I need to hear something different. And it doesn't work for me.
Yeah.
They're just used to, okay, this is what we do. This is why we do it. Repetition. And they're not trying to like get away from problems. They're more just, they understand it takes a long time and they've had that steadiness in their life, good and bad, where I think it really helps players to have long-term coaching. I know I had it. It gave me a lot of confidence, but I think it helps people down the road.
Not shopping and bopping.
I read about your number six. I talked to her mother briefly, but I just read this the other night. I like to read about number sixes. I think it's fascinating how good number sixes are. And we could talk a little bit about Stacky. Maybe it's not always a true number six, but with Eric Martinez was here with his family, a great guy. His name was mentioned for working with your number six, but in Milwaukee, he did tell me that that's a problem. I think it's a problem everywhere where, you know, people will bop and shop. Yeah. They don't stay with the same coach. And I think there's two sides to that. Sometimes it's like, okay,
But I mean, it's two sides to it. Are you lucky enough to get a good coach?
Right, exactly.
I mean, it's not the player's fault if the information's not there or they're in a situation where they can't get it. But I think that's kind of the point, right? Is, you know, we've talked about this. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, we all like to get on players and stuff, but really it's the coaches who are failing the system, I think, and myself included.
Could you say that again?
It's the coaches that are failing the system. I don't believe any kid who has an inefficient swing or tactics, it's necessarily their fault.
Well, yeah,
of course, they got to listen and do better, but it's us as the coaches who need to do better.
I think there's also this side of it is that it's two different skill sets, really. You want to combine them as one, but teaching is information transfer. Coaching is a human relationship, a chemistry, a magic. I think the biggest problem is teaching, is people don't have the information. I'm always asking, is it no information or bad information? I worked with a coach from Peru for 15 years, and like yourself, he speaks Spanish a little better than you, but he's from Peru. But what he would say in English, he just watches someone hit for the warm-up, play first couple games, he just looks at you and goes, no information. And there's so many kids that are out there, and they're doing quite well with just the human spirit, just the willpower.
Yeah.
And it's like, could you imagine if this kid knew how to hit the ball?
Yeah, but it's like I said, I think, go back to the first point, I think one of the scary, you know, the one thing I got perspective on in California is it is a business. And you know, the nice thing about college, it's not like we worry about saying things or doing things where we're going to not have a group the next week or something like this, you know. But I was told very clearly, if you learn skills and you learn how to teach technique in this system, you will grow a client base over time that will stay with you for a long term, and you will never worry about finances and money. And that's exactly what happened to me in California. And I think most people, that's a positive, right? If you can move from Georgia with no money, straight out of school as a young married couple, and 4 years later you're buying a home in California, you're doing okay. Mm-hmm. And that was because I had a system to back me up, which gave me, number one, information, but two, I had Jimmy and Brandon to help me. I had, you know, you obviously started helping me more and more over time as we got connected, but I had people to check my work. I had, you know, I mean, the Southern Cal was interesting. We played yesterday. Four of those six girls were in my group. I worked with most of them individually through high school. In fact, six of my former players were on Southern Cal last year. I saw 9 ATA players yesterday in parents. And this is the Sweet 16. You know, this isn't just like an invitational. So the level, and Jimmy and I were talking about this last night, and the reason that happened was, I can tell you, one of the reasons my group started to grow is I got a few players who were doing very well, but I actually inherited them from Mark Walpole. But Mark Walpole and I have never had an in-person discussion, but I think he knew the players coming to us had the information that he was teaching, and we knew the players coming from him, we could do things that maybe the regular person working on off the street would find unusual. So that connectivity is really what helped everything grow. And I think a lot of coaches, if they knew that, would be like, you know what? I need to get part of a system, right? If they give me the information, I go out and do it. All of a sudden, I've got a network of support. And I think that's the toughest part, because people really, when they start coaching, they're really just out there to survive, right? And it's tough.
Mark Walpole was a student of ours. He's also, like yourself, from England. His co-coach or partner sent me a text today. He's bringing his son out here the next few days to work on his serve. I think one thing about the business, you know, Andy and I have both lived and worked in Southern Cal. With Jimmy, I always tease Jimmy. I've known Jimmy since he was 18. Jimmy Johnson, his brother Joey, Jimmy's nephew, Joey's son Spencer, who's going to UCLA next year, was part of one of our podcasts. All these tennis connections. Ed Kras, I talked to him just a couple days ago. He used to say about Tampa, as in regard to tennis teaching, if you can make it in this town, you can make it anywhere. but I really think that it's really tough to make it in Southern Cal. With Jimmy and his older brother Joey, you talked to him about it, is, you know, our business model is we like to have people, and it's a nominal fee, but we have people pay us. And it doesn't, you know, they pay a fee and they learn, and then they can observe, and maybe it's a work study. But I think it's even tougher in a place like Southern Cal. Florida's right up there, but when you have an environment that's filled with better players, the glorified sparring partner, you know, people come off the tour and they don't think they have to pay any dues, and they just, you know, like instant coffee, they can coach. That's the way you put that. To go from Georgia to go to Southern Cal,
Southern Cal is different. I mean, I got a taste of it in Barcelona. I mean, I was probably, I don't know, in juniors in England, let's say I was 10, right? And I go to a small club in Spain and I'm like the 20th best player. It's like, what is going on here? I didn't even know about these guys. Like, Southern Cal, you see like a homeless guy in the park and you're like, well, that guy, you know, he had two wins over Sampras in juniors. And you're like, what? Who is this guy? And there's so many former players walking around. So it works both ways. It's hyper competitive.
Yeah. Delray Beach and Boca Raton. I was in that town from 74 on. I was there seven years. I can remember Mario Martinez. I think he was, you know, top 30 in the world. But at the same time, Steffi Graf and Lendl had places in Boca, so it's pretty.
Well, I mean, Andy knows Kyle Spencer, the men's coach, who's a tremendous player who played in the Olympics. Kyle told me a story that his father just passed. He told me a story as well that their first coach, who got Kyle to like top 10 in the section, was actually a homeless guy. They didn't realize he was homeless until 2 years later. But that's the level of tennis people that are literally hanging around in Southern Cal. But the other good thing about Southern Cal is there's a good BS meter. Like when some people come in from the outside and they try and run some of these weird things a lot, there's enough good players around where they're like, nah, that doesn't work. there is a better meter there for sniffing it out, you know. And you know, if you get found out in Southern Cal, you're not going to survive financially, you know. So it does weed out a little bit some of the stuff that's going on.
Yeah,
I know you're going to have to take your team to dinner here shortly, but talk a little bit about stacking. Tell us what that is, and does that take place?
So stacking does take place. Stacking is where, you know, in college tennis, you're supposed to play your strongest player at one, your next strongest player at two. But obviously, there's no objective measure to say who is your strongest player. I mean, for example, our number one doubles team is ranked lower. I think they're ranked 10, and our number two team is ranked 5. So people could say, well, you're stacking. But I think most people who eyeball it would say, well, Rogers and Smith should be one. They've been one. But the, we actually think it doesn't work. Basically, the logic is, let's say you're 4, 5, 6. You're not great at 4, but you'd be good at 5 and 6. So what you do is you take your 6, you put them at 4, and then your 4 moves down to 5, your 5 moves down to 6. So what teams do is, if they win the doubles point, so the doubles is played first, whoever wins 2 out of 3 gets the point. If they win the doubles point, they keep the lineup as is. You're allowed to remove players after doubles. They keep it as is. They say, well, we've got the doubles point, so that's 1. We'll throw, let's say, number 4, but we're going to be really strong at 5 and 6. So we'll take 2 out of 3 here, because we basically we'll void the doubles point. If they don't win the doubles point, then they just pull the 4 and roll in where they should be, and they have to go for it. But it works. It can work on a day, but when you get to the championship season, your lineups have to be pre-approved. So you always know it's a stack when they present their lineups for, let's say, the ACC, the conference championships, or the NCAA championships, and it's like a player's never played 4, and all of a sudden they're listed at 4, and everybody is allowed to appeal it. And if there's an appeal and it gets overturned, you actually get fined. So Simon and I have been very strong proponents. He tried to propose it last year. I think it's going to get pushed through this year, saying that each week, so in the ACC, there'll be a proposal, say, and the SEC already does this. They've done a good job. You have to send your lineup in on Wednesday for the Friday, Saturday rotation, and everybody gets to vote on your lineup. Because it shouldn't be that your lineup suddenly changes at the end of the year. Because what that basically means is you're just matching up week to week, and that's what we're trying to avoid. The pushback is some people say, well, you don't know my lineup as well as I do, and I agree with that, or that there should just be no rules and you could put a player wherever you want. But it's real. It occurs. Every year I get asked the question, so Dave, how are you going to play your lineup to get the best possible score? Yeah. Like, we're going to play our 1 at 1 and our 2 at 2 and our 3 at 3. And maybe we're missing the picture, but no, it's something we're very against, but it's going on, yeah.
Another question along the same lines. I know it's done many different ways. What are your thoughts on forming a lineup?
Yeah, I mean, we try to play a lot in the summer and the fall. And it's one thing Simon really believes in, is playing the strongest possible schedule. And we hope that by the time we get to the spring, if we're 30 matches in, we can see who is. We don't have, I would say, an objective system for it, but
you don't need challenge hope that matches, things like that, in-house.
Don't. I think that's something probably Steve found funnier. We actually barely even play a set in practice. It's very rare. With the pandemic, we did it because we weren't playing tournaments in the fall. We were playing matches against each other, like league system. But I can tell you, Armstrong, we had a year where we won a national title with the girls, and we did not play one set against each other in practice. Which is maybe strange to some people, but we actually do not play challenge matches, challenge system. We've done it more and more recently, just because we've had a little bit. What we try to do is just play so many tournaments that not so much of an issue.
Some thoughts on the pandemic for our listeners. The pluses, the minuses, the silver lining. How's it impacted college tennis today, then in the next couple of years?
I think the pluses are, hopefully it drives tennis back a little bit more locally. I think there's been a big push to, I think UTR is obviously, I think they've just like knocked it out of the park with the tournaments and stuff. They've made it so easy to play. I hope that drives things back locally, where families aren't spending an arm and a leg going around the country to play tournaments for ranking points, where it's just like, okay, just play, you know, just keep it local, keep it often, and just play. The negatives, there was some negative impact for sure on this recruiting class, you know. So to give you an example, with recruiting, players were offered an extended year of eligibility. And it will phase out after this year. But to give you an example, the players who played 1 and 3 for me, they're actually 5th years. So they're what you call super seniors, or they got the extra year. Yeah. So if you would have looked at my recruiting for 21 this year, you would have said, well, he's got 3 seniors, so he's got 3 scholarships, right? And so that means there were 3 spots available for us. 2 of our 3 are going to – coaches have been given the option to give our players – have our players for an extra year, but obviously that means we can't bring in a freshman moving forward, right? I mean, obviously for us, we just said, you know, we would much rather just keep our players. So I should have had 3 scholarships for this year, so that's 3 opportunities for recruits. Now, one of our girls is moving on. She's a physics major. She's going to go to Purdue. Probably Purdue, I think, but she's going to go to a very specific degree major, but the other 2 are going to play on with us. So in a year where NC State should be giving 3 scholarships to incoming freshmen, now we only have 1. So I think for this year's recruiting class, it's really had a negative impact. And I think for recruits, it's caused a lot of anxiety. A lot of coaches don't necessarily know what they have scholarship wise because it's depending on players making a decision.
Yeah.
And the decisions have come late. So I think it's caused a lot of anxiety for recruits. This year's class really got hurt by it. It was definitely an unintended consequence of the rule. But also, you know, we June 1, they let us out into the wild to recruit again. But we have not been out recruiting since last March. Wow. And I think it's causing a lot of anxiety for junior players. They just don't know, you know.
I heard this from Javier Palenque. Palenque?
Palenque.
Andy's a little better with pronunciations.
David's got it too, right?
His last name. But Javier, deep thinker for the improvement of tennis, he told me that the governing bodies of tennis around the world should extend junior tennis to either under 19 or under 20 because of what happened with COVID.
Well, yeah, I mean, the NCAA granted an extra year.
But not junior tennis though, correct?
They did for this year. Okay. Not for the 21s, but for the 20s. Mm-hmm. If they were negatively influenced, they were giving them relief on that for a year. For this year's group, 20, like for the 22s, life will be back to normal. I think the ones who got hurt were the 21s this year, the high school kids, really got crushed by it. Mm-hmm. They were just opportunities taken off the board for them. It was not their fault. But, you know, I think most college coaches, I mean, you know, my 1 and 3, I've been working hard with them 4 or 5 years. You give me another opportunity to have another year with them. I mean, it wasn't even a discussion. They were like, Dave, we're coming back, right? And I was like, yeah. It's the unintended consequence was what happened with this year's recruiting class.
Speaking of juniors, just before you have to get out of here, I just wanted you to tell our listeners a little bit, either juniors or parents of juniors, what, you know, some general advice maybe, but I know one of the things we talked about is, you know, you've got very good players coming in, but you really had to attack the fitness was one of the big things right away. But maybe you could just go through some general advice and some advice for junior players listening or their parents.
Some things we're seeing kind of across the board, general things we're seeing. I mean, I have some athletic freshmen. I've had some athletic freshmen over the years, but I have not met a fit freshman yet. I mean, you know, and you can't lie when you're wearing a heart rate monitor. I see their numbers in the practices and, more importantly, the recovery when they sit on the bench between work, you know, between drills. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're just struggling the first year. It takes some of it, the intensity, some of it, I don't know what they've been doing their senior year. Sometimes they get, you know, they get a little bit of freedom once they get the car, but I have not met a fit freshman yet. And I want to be clear, athletic, yes. I've had some very athletic freshmen, but their fitness and their conditioning, you're really, the first year is really just tactical and fitness.
I was telling you,
we don't really.
Go ahead.
What's that?
I'm sorry to interrupt. I was just going to say, I told David Goetz from UPenn, one of his incoming players here training, that, you know, he likes to get his players to run a 5:30. We've got almost a half dozen boys that are in the 16s that can run 5:10 or under. But no, we have kids come in and they run a mile and they're tough. It's hard to even say that they have a hard time.
I can tell you, Simon can tell you my mile times, but I can tell you when I was in college, I mean, I was 200 pounds when I played. I was a 5:15 and I was last on my team.
Wow.
I mean, we had guys in the 4:40s. I mean, at Armstrong, you couldn't find the team if you couldn't run a 5:30.
What would be the benchmarks then you would tell, like, okay, hey, if you, you know, juniors out there, what are some of the benchmarks they need to try to meet?
Well, I think miles is an easy one. But I mean, I would deal more with the women's, but I can tell you Armstrong, we had teams where every single guy ran a 5:30 and could bench press 200 pounds. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was normal. But I think push-ups wise, I mean, if you're not, you should be able to do 25 to 50 solid push-ups as a male. As a female, we like to come in at about, if freshmen are coming in at 20, I have girls who can't do a push-up when they come in.
Yeah,
they can do one good push-up. Pull-ups, I think if we're getting up to 10 and better, that's a decent starting point. I mean, you at least have to show that you've been doing them.
No, that echoes.
If you cannot.
Sorry to interrupt again. That echoes what we talked about with Mr. Hopman. But go ahead. If you can't do one.
Yeah, I mean, if you can't do one, it shows that you haven't even tried to be doing one, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Because anybody can do that. I mean, I think fitness is the one thing. Athleticism is different because it shows really what you've been trained with. But fitness is just repetition, right? Like anybody can learn to do a push-up.
Yeah.
Well, kids are getting better with their thumbs. I mean, you got to put the cell phone away.
Yeah, I think other things, I emailed you about this, I think, when you said it. And I think it's true, certainly when I was growing up and in tendencies before, were that players were stronger on the backhand volley with a continental grip and struggled on the forehand volley. I always just remember that discussion with my coaches. That was the worst shot on the pro tour was the forehand volley. Mm. Now, I would say the tendency is players are more on a composite or an Eastern on the forehand volley.
Yeah.
But they're using that on the backhand volley. So the backhand volley is really struggling right now.
Yeah.
That is something we work on religiously.
No, and really, little kids, we show this film of Pete Sampras hitting a two-handed backhand volley. You have a better chance to develop a one-handed backhand volley by hitting a two-handed backhand volley.
Yeah. No, the girl who said to me yesterday, I should have closed on the volley. It was said this morning, I said, no, I should never have let you convince me not to put you on two hands. I mean, I put two hands on three of them, at least their first year, and then just worked them through the progression. Mm. But one of them, I don't know how she convinced me not to, but she said, no, it's a one-handed volley. It's not, but I failed her on that. I told her this summer, we're putting two hands on it.
Well, it's good for us to hear that this summer, I mean, that's where you really have to go to work as a college coach. Yeah. I think it's not really for the best. You know, a lot of these college kids, I think, I got to go play pro tennis. Is that pro tennis can wait. Work on your skills. Be in college when you're in college.
I know
you're running for time. Who do you play next in the tournament? I think that's an exciting
University of Georgia.
Okay. Have you played him already this season?
We didn't. Normally we played him. We were supposed to play him, but with the COVID travel rules, it didn't happen this year. We were scheduled to play him twice this year almost, but we've played them in the indoors the last 2 years. I mean, they're very strong. 2 years ago, they won the indoors. They were the runner-up in the national. Last year, they beat us in the indoors that year in a tough match. Last year, we beat them in the indoors, but we never played them outdoors. This year, we never got to play them there. They're one of the, you know, kind of the blue blood programs in women's tennis. Experienced team, very physically tough team. And obviously good in the heat, they're used to it. But no, they'll be a very, very tough out if we get through them.
Yeah. We'll come over and watch. Bring some juniors to watch. Andy, anything else? This has been great.
No, it's been really great having you on, David.
I appreciate everything you guys have done for me. You guys have, especially Mr. Smith over the years, it's been a huge resource to me. I must owe you a bill. I don't think I've ever paid you a dollar, but
I'll have my wife send a bill.
Yeah. I get one thing I will tell you, and the list is there are programs that my girls, when they walked into your place the other day, they were like, I know this place, Dave. They know your voices. Yeah. They know voice. I wish they could have get more of Vic, because I think, you know, obviously he had that. I'm looking forward to that podcast most, but
yeah,
a number of clips I've showed them.
Yeah, I try to put some Vic videos up every once in a while. I've got a bunch I need to edit in my library.
Yeah, But no, they know your voices and they're consuming the content along with me. They're much better on a phone than I am. But I do appreciate what you guys are doing, especially I know now that Andy's come on, it's a little bit more technically advanced. But we really appreciate what you guys are doing.
It's better looking too, just overall, a lot better style.
Well, Steve and I joke that you have a face for radio.
Face for radio. Yeah, I need to be on the big silver screen.
No, but I've got Steve on his good side here on the video.
And you and your wife, you've got a four-year-old boy. Is he going to be able to hit a forehand well?
He's in gymnastics and swimming right now. He's a monstrous child. He was an 11-pound baby. He's a big boy. I just want him to play everything right now. He loves tennis.
I'll say a prayer that he has his mother's talent.
Oh, God. Yeah.
My last question, though, is you know that I'm good friends with your queen. And I don't want you to answer this, but I will ask you this when I see you at the tournament. What's your take on Kate Middleton?
Kate Middleton? You're talking about
isn't it Kate Middleton?
No, that's not. Kate Middleton is married to William. What's Harry's wife? Meghan Markle.
See, I couldn't even ask the question. Jeez.
Gosh dang it, Smith.
I do know the queen well. This is a fact-based program. She calls me twice a week to talk to me about great base tennis.
So Meghan Markle, it really depends where you live. If you live on this side of the pond, then everything that she said is, oh my God, it's outrageous. But obviously on the other side of the pond, it is unquestioning loyalty to the crown, no matter what. So it's like that can't possibly have happened, you know?
Yeah.
And the royal family in England is a funny old thing. I'm a fairly logical person. Got a couple of science degrees, but I could not tell you why we love the Queen so much, but we do. So anytime anything ever challenges the Queen, we're 100% sure that's wrong.
Well, I was watching 60 Minutes. I didn't have any idea that the Oprah interview was coming on. I did not leave my chair. I listened to the whole thing.
And then
what happens when you watch something like that? Then you say, okay, I got to read this and read that. And anyway, I'm good friends with the Queen, so I'm with the Queen.
Well, you just let her know not to forget about me now that I live over here.
All right. But no, thanks a lot, Dave. It's been great. Appreciate you being on.
Thank you for having me on.
We'll see you soon.
See you at the tournament. Good luck.
Good luck, yeah.
Thank you. Take care.
Cheers. Later. Well, I thought that was great. Covered a lot of stuff on...
Yeah, another short podcast. I think that was another
college tennis
45
minutes. That was like 22 minutes long.
No, a sharp guy. I hope our listeners got a lot out of that. I know I did.
Yeah, it's just fun to see them have success and to be able to use some of those tools that David has learned over the years and see it in action. It's fun to see that.
Yeah, you know, and really basics, fundamentals, it's part of every sport at every level. So,
yeah.
So
teach basics.
Yes. Be brilliant with basics. Vince Lombardi, 101.
Yeah.
But... Yeah, I think it's time to sign off so everybody can take a nap.
Yeah, thanks everybody for listening, and we will see you in the next one for sure. Find us online, greatbasetennis.com, free courses on social media at greatbasetennis. If you get a chance to leave us a review on iTunes, Apple, that would be appreciated.
Yeah, 40 podcasts through the first year, 52. We need to talk about two more pillars, Dennis Vandermeer, Vic Braden, a few other things we want to cover in the first year.
That's coming up.
But in the second year, we're going to bring out Andy's personality.
I don't have any.
It's going to be fun.
it's going to be fun. Come on. These are fun.
A lot of time.
Oh, good.
But they're there. I mean, someone said to me the other day, they love the Welby Van Horn podcast we had. Your wife does all these things to help organize this. 2 hours and 45 minutes.
Yeah.
That was long. Anyway.
All right, kids.
It's there to listen to.
Auf Wiedersehen.
Yeah, thanks.
See you in the next one.